Rosenthal's Variations on Alaska's Flag Song. Well, my guest in the studio this morning, Mr. Roy Larson, a pleasant good morning to you, Roy.
Good morning.
Nice to have you here today on this ice-foggy Friday. Found your way to the studio okay here at 11th and Cushman. Before we get into your history, I got a phone call this morning from Mo Samuelson, who reminded me to ask you, or to tell you, says, Gail, are you aware that he's Roy A.A. Larson? I said, yes, I am. I want to ask you about that. Roy A.A. Larson, what's the A.A.?
Well, I was named Roy A. Larson, no middle name. And when I went to start the University of Washington, I had taken a postgraduate course to bring up my credits, and they called me very irate that I had just taken subjects over to raise my grades, and it really wasn't according to Hoyle. And I told them no such thing. So I got into the office, and they pulled out the sheets to show me, and there had a Roy E. Larson who made his E like my A. So I said, I'll fix that. I'll just add another A. Since then, it's been Roy A.A.
So when people see you in the phone book, that's the story.
That's the story.
It stands for something, but not what we thought.
Well, I was actually named after my two grandfathers, whose first names started with A, Andrew and Albert.
Oh, my.
So, so actually, it's semi-legal.
Ah, so as it turns out, yeah. Well, you, Washington, so you were born in?
In Granite Falls, Washington, in June the 21st, 1914. Uh-huh. I was a war baby. That's when they started the First World War.
Uh-huh. So you're 70 years old. You'll be 71
right.
In June. Uh-huh. Now, where did you grow up?
I grew up in Everett. We moved into Everett when I was about a year old. And I went all through grade school and junior high and high school in Everett.
Mm-hmm.
And graduated there a semester early because when I got through the junior high school, the ninth grade, I was too smart to go on to school. But my mother said she didn't care how smart I was. I had to have a diploma. So I finally conceded and told her I'd go back to school as long as I could go through as easy and fast as I could just to get the diploma. And that's why I had to go back and take a postgraduate course to go to college later.
Oh, you just wanted to get out so you can get into the working world.
Sure.
When did you graduate from high school?
In January in 1932.
Huh. Well, what did you do after you graduated then?
Well, to start with, in the spring of that year or winter, I cut pulpwood, which was, it was right in the bottom of the Depression, and supposedly there was no work, but anybody that wanted to go to work and work could cut pulpwood. And I got my job, and cutting pulpwood at that time consisted of falling your own trees, which were fir and hemlock, about 2 to 2.5 feet in diameter, and then limbing them and sawing them up in 4'6" lengths, and chipping off all the bark and splitting them in pieces no bigger than 7.5 inches across, and stacking them in piles that were 4 feet high and 8 feet long, which consisted of a cord.
And you had to do all of that?
Yes.
Oh.
And I was one of the few in the woods that could average cutting a cord a day because I didn't smoke. I didn't have to take pipe. So everybody wanted me for a partner, but I didn't go for partners.
Huh. Do you remember what you made doing that kind of work?
It was $1.50 a cord for fir and $1.75 for spruce.
And it took a day to do that?
10 hours, yeah.
So you made $1.75.
Yeah.
Doing very hard work, and it took you 10 hours of hard work to earn $1.75.
And with the $1.75, I paid out $30 for a second-hand truck. I had the best tools that I could buy. I had the best clothes I could buy, and I had money in my pocket.
Gee whiz. Well, what did you do after that? What happened next?
Then in the spring, my My brother and I went to Montana, where I had an aunt north of Shelby, right up against the Canadian line almost in the Sweetgrass Hills. And we worked for him all summer, and my aunt and uncle all summer, and then my brother went back to the coast, and we got $30 a month board and room for that.
Hmm.
And in the fall, why, they quit paying wages, you just work for your board and room. But I decided to stay on, so that's what I was doing, but I didn't get any paid anything because the price of wheat was going up, and the it was about 45 cents a bushel when we got there, and in the fall it was up to 65 and going up a little bit almost every day. So my uncle wouldn't sell the wheat to pay me, but he wouldn't give me the wheat either. And as the months went by, why, it made me more irritated. And Christmas time, why, the railroads came out with an ad. You could go anywhere you wanted to on the railroads for Christmas vacation for a one-way plus 25 cents. So I decided to go down to Nebraska and see my grandparents. And my uncle very irritatedly hauled some wheat to town, sold it so he could pay me off so I could go to Nebraska. But I didn't like Nebraska because there was nothing there that you could see. It was just flat. Look all day and see nothing. So I came back to Montana, and in the meantime he had hired another man to take my place, and so I found another job, and this man decided I shouldn't work for board and room, that I should have something, so he offered to give me a horse for my winter's work. And in the spring we rode out and round up the loose horses he had, and he picked out the one he was going to give me, and we brought it in. It was a little mare, and I rode it once and tied it in the barn, and he tied his saddle mare in alongside of it, and saddle mare was a pet and very spoiled and wearing cork shoes, which are on each horseshoe they had four spikes about 3/4 of an inch long, so to help the saddle horse stay up on the frozen ground. And he just kicked the daylights out of that little mare of mine, and it got blood poison, and it finally died. And I insisted he should give me another one because it was his fault. He knew better. And he didn't think so. So instead of working for him that summer, like everybody knew I should, why, I went back over and worked for my uncle because he fired his hired man in the meantime. And so everybody around the country would ask me why I wasn't working for this other fella, and they would ask him too, and he had his story and I had mine, and they started kidding him, and so along the middle of the summer he couldn't take it anymore, and he sent word over for me to come and get another horse, which the neighbor kids and I went over and got. It was about 7 miles to where he lived. And then in the fall I sold the horse to the neighbor kids for $2.50 and a worn out 22.
About what
the horse was worth $5.
We'll be back with Roy Larson in just a moment on Meet a Pioneer. Alaska is still a land of pioneers, like the Binkley family, who for three generations have operated riverboats in the state of Alaska.
Running the riverboat Discovery has given our family the opportunity to show so many others just a little corner of the Alaska we love. That's also one of the reasons we're proud to be a sponsor of Meet a Pioneer. This program gives us all a chance to find out more about the fascinating history of this special place we call Alaska, and we look forward to each week's program. We're looking forward to seeing you again next summer aboard the Riverboat Discovery.
Today is February 22nd, 1985. This is Meet a Pioneer with Roy Larson. So you're worth $5.
Yeah. And as a prelude to that story of the horse, in the early 1960s, I was out at Eielson working on a safe, and a man came into the store and asked if I was around, and my wife, Eva, told him I was out on a service call, so he said he'd come back in an hour or so, and he did come back, and I wasn't back in the store yet, so he said, well, Roy worked for me in Montana, and she says, oh, you're the man with the horse. And it was.
And it had been all those years. You hadn't seen him in the meantime?
No.
Oh, goodness.
And he turned out his daughter is here in town. She is the wife of Jack Bucher of Bucher Glass.
Small world.
And she was, her and her brother were in Shelby going to school for the winter while I worked for her dad. So.
Oh, my goodness. After all those years, huh? Mm. Well, so you, after that, you picked apples and whatnot and lettuce and worked a lot of hard work in your younger years.
Sure. Work is good for you.
Uh-huh.
And I came back from Montana and immediately went east of the mountains and to Cashmere, Washington, and picked apples and came back for the winter and didn't do much that winter except eat apples. I brought truckloads of them back.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the spring, we went to work in the lettuce warehouse in Woodinville, Washington, where the big interchange is now. And when that was over, we went back east to eastern Washington to Cashmere again, and I went to work in the Pacific Fruit and Produce Warehouse.
Uh-huh.
And for the next 2-3 years, that was my program. But working in the apples, I found out that in Cashmere, the people just worked in the summertime and fall. When in the early spring, they would do their pruning and then all their irrigating and stuff to get the apples growing and spray and so forth. And in the fall, they'd pick apples and work in the packing plants. And now all the kids would go to college. So I decided a bunch of them stupid kids could go to college. I could, too. So, and when I was in high school, I had taken a carpentry class, and we built a house for a man. And I got to be good friends with him and some of his friends who worked in the Everett Stove Works, and it was very slow, so they took the summer off and went up in the Caribou country in Canada to mine, and so I got interested in mining. So when I decided to go to college, I didn't know anything else to take, so I decided to be a mining engineer.
Uh-huh.
And in order to go to college, I had to go back and take my postgraduate course, and takes physics 1 and 2 and chemistry 1 and 2 and algebra, and I had and geometry. I had the six so-called heavy subjects, and then I went to college then for about 2/4 out of the year, the next couple of years, and got into working for the dean of the School of Mines at the University of Washington. And in the winter of 37-38, I started looking for some place to work in the mines, and there just wasn't any mining going on in Washington at all. So it was suggested to come to Alaska to, and the dean guaranteed me a job at the Alaska Juno mine, but I didn't feel too much like working underground in the massive operation they had. And my girlfriend, who was a nurse at the Swedish hospital, and I, we'd take rides on Sundays and run down people who had been to Alaska, and they all said you should come up to the interior and you could work in the summertime and go to school in the winter. It was a good mining school. And so that was what I finally decided to do. And on a Tuesday morning, we decided that I definitely was coming up to interior Alaska and then She told me that, well, if I was going to Alaska, either we'd get married first or just forget it, because she wasn't going to stick around there all summer and just wonder if I was going to send for her. So we decided to come on Tuesday, got married on Thursday, and I left her on Saturday. Got on the, I sold the car I had at the time for $60 or $65, and I had a few more dollars, not many. Cost $40 to come on the Alaska steamship to Seward, and I think about 10 from Seward to Fairbanks, as long as you didn't stay in the get a hotel room at Curry.
Mm-hmm.
So it took 2 days to get to Fairbanks, and I landed in Fairbanks on the 21st of April in 1939.
April 21st, 1939, you were 25 years old.
Mm-hmm.
You were newly married, hadn't even had a honeymoon yet, left your bride back in Washington. And her name?
It was Eva Cayley, was her maiden name.
Uh-huh. We'll be back with Roy Larson on Meet a Pioneer in just a moment.
Bank has seen a lot of history, and their solid background of investment and involvement in the community has earned Mount McKinley their own place in Fairbanks history. Mount McKinley Mutual Savings Bank is proud to sponsor Meet a Pioneer. At Mount McKinley, they're looking forward to a future as proud as their past.
Alaskans have always been famous for their hospitality, the same wonderful hospitality you still find at the Two Rivers Lodge, where Don and Stasha Troutman offer the best menu and interior, a comfortable, quiet atmosphere, and that famous Alaskan welcome to the people who are today's history makers. If you've been meaning to try one of the most talked about dining experiences in the Alaskan interior, don't wait any longer. Go out tonight to the Two Rivers Lodge, 16 mile Chena Hot Springs Road.
Meet a Pioneer is sponsored in part by the Forget-Me-Not Gift Shop. Sam and Jane McConkie believe beautiful things are timeless, and everything you find at the Forget-Me-Not shop is beautiful. Fine linens, silver, crystal, decorator items for your home or office, and that little something for special friends. Forget-Me-Not adds a feeling of luxury to even the most practical items. So, for beautiful things for years to come, for your friends, your home, or for yourself, remember the Forget-Me-Not Gift Shop, open 10 to 6, 6 days a week in Northgate Square.
Years ago, Mount McKinley Bank was founded by a group of forward-looking individuals who saw a need in the community. The new bank offered low-interest loans to encourage new home building in the Fairbanks area. It was an immediate success. Today, Mount McKinley Mutual Savings Bank is still located at 530 4th Avenue in the same building where founder Julian Rice and First President Judge Vernon Forbes served on the first board of trustees. The bank has seen a lot of history, and their solid background of investment and involvement in the community has earned Mount McKinley their own place in Fairbanks history. Mount McKinley Mutual Savings Bank is proud to sponsor Meet a Pioneer. At Mount McKinley, they're looking forward to a future as proud as their past.
Thank you very much to all of our sponsors. And now welcome back to Meet a Pioneer with my guest this morning, Roy Larson. Well, you landed in Fairbanks April 21st, 1939. What did you think? First of all, did you know where you're going? Did you know anybody?
Well, I knew several people I met on the boat. Other than that, nobody.
Huh.
And I had $20 in my pocket. And one of the fellows I met coming up was in about the same condition I was financially.
Uh-huh.
So we found a place to stay overnight at the old Pioneer Hotel in the basement.
Where was that located then?
It was located where the Greyland Hotel is now.
Okay.
And it was, I forget what they called it. It was not very nice, but it was just a series of bunks, four or five bunks over each other, and You just went down there and flopped.
Down in the basement, huh?
Yes. And so the next day we...
What did it cost you?
$1 per night.
Uh-huh.
The next day we decided to see if we couldn't find something cheaper and cleaner. And we just went from house to house asking if they had any place we could stay until we went out to work. And we finally found a house over on Fifth Avenue, which was the Otto Bayless house. Otto Bayless was the road commission foreman, and he ran the ferry down at Big Delta during the summertime. And he has one son that's down at Copper Center now, John Bayless, a couple of grandsons. It cost us 50 cents a night to stay there. And
you mean he had a room or rooms where he would put up people?
No, it was a dining room. They just took the table out, and it had like a couch on each side of it, and the table, where the table was, and each of us took a couch.
Is that right? Gosh.
So, and to eat, we went to the old Frisk Bakery, which was down in the back of the China building on First Avenue. And they baked bread, and they had a very famous long counter that went up and down the way the earth had changed under it. And they had the old copper coffee pot that always had lots of coffee in it, and real good coffee. And they made sandwiches, and I think they made three kinds of sandwiches. The ones I remember were the ham sandwiches, and they were all on their homemade bread, big thick slices of bread, and lots of meat, and I believe they had cheese in them. And they cost 50 cents, and that was our meal for the day.
One sandwich a day.
One sandwich and two or three cups of coffee.
Well, 50 cents for food, 50 cents for your couch, $1 a day, $20 in your pocket, you had to find a job.
That's right. And I went over at the FE company and got in and talked to Mr. Erling, who was the head cheese over there. And he's the one that Earl Cook was a secretary to.
Uh-huh.
And told him that I was a student from the University of Washington and intend going to college here at the university. And so he said, well, just keep coming in every morning and see what showed up. And so the 5th of May, they had a ditch break up on the old Davidson ditch up at Medicine Creek. It's up the other side of Long Creek. And so there was about 20 of us went up there and went to work and repairing the ditch break. And we stayed at Long Creek and just drove back and forth. And when that was fixed, they put us down to Chattanooga as point drivers. And I spent the summer at the Chattanooga camp driving points. And we got 79 cents an hour, worked 10 hours a day and 7 days a week.
Woody Johansson was on the program a few weeks ago. He did that. He said it was the hardest work he ever did.
Ah, it wasn't bad.
Huh. You were in shape for it, though, I guess, from all the work you did. Well, describe point driving.
Well, in order to thaw the ground, the way the FE company came up with was to get cold water running down into it. Uh-huh. And the water would thaw faster than anything else and very much cheaper. That's why they built that 85 miles of Davidson Ditch.
Uh-huh.
And they would have a pipe, like a 3/4-inch pipe with a spade point on it, and then a hole out on each side for the water to get out of. And then they'd have a gooseneck hose at the top of it for the water to run into it. And we had a 20-pound clamp that we put on it, on the pipe, and this clamp had a handle 2 feet long, wooden handle. And then there was a U-shaped hammer which slid up and down the pipe, and it was about 8 inches long and almost 2.5 or 3 inches in diameter. But it would just slide onto the pipe, and then there was a 3/8-inch rod that went through holes in the front part of the U to hold it on the pipe, and that rod was the handle to lift the clamp and bring it down on the clamp to drive the pipe down. And you'd hit the clamp with this hammer and then take the wooden handles and the clamp and twist the pipe and up again with the hammer and down, and just what you did until the pipe quit moving, and then you'd take the clamp off and move on to the next point and drive it down until it was through what had thawed. You had about 15 or 20, and you'd just go up and down the line all day. And
so you get the ones put in, and you go back to the first one, take it out, and move it up to the front, and
just keep moving the clamp from.
And you had to, so you force this rod. You had to just with your, just force it and twist it down into the ground.
Yes.
All day long, 10 hours a day.
Yes.
79 cents an hour. Sounds a pretty hard work.
You didn't have to feel sorry for yourself.
Well, what kind of physical condition were you in with this kind of work?
Oh, they were in the best physical condition you could get.
You look like a muscle man.
And the old-timers would lift the clamp and, or lift the hammer and hit the clamp and twist it and say, "Easy money in Alaska."
Easy money, old-timers, huh?
Yeah.
No, they fed you.
They fed us very, very good.
Uh-huh.
We paid $45 a month for board and room. And, at today's prices, we would not pay for one meal. We had three different kinds of crews at the camp. There was the people that worked on the dredge who didn't really do any physical work, except, just a very short time, if any. Some of them just pulled levers, and some, waited for the dredge to move, then they'd have to move the cables and things like that. And they'd sit around and gripe about the food being rotten, and they'd finally eat what little they wanted to eat and get their dessert and get up and leave. And the other two groups were the bull gang, who moved the pipes around, and they did a lot of work. And the point drivers, and when the others would leave, usually it would end up why just the point drivers were at the table, and it was a family style deal. They'd just fill the table with food, and by the time the others had left, we'd gone through our second helping, and then whatever was left on the table, why, we'd just divide up and eat. There was never anything left when we left the table.
I bet. A lot of hard work. Young guys working hard. Well, you were riding, you and Eva are riding back and forth during this time and keeping in touch, the newlyweds. Well, tell me the story about your haircut.
Well, when my hair got kind of long out there in Chattanooga, and we had a little fellow that cut hair for 50 cents. And so one night we decided I should get my hair cut. And so he took his clippers and he started in my forehead and he went right over the top of my head. And then he evened it all up. So I turned out bald. And so to make a kind of a joke out of it, we each of us had an FE number. And we made a sign and put it across my chest and took a picture of me as a convict. but I didn't show it to Eva until she got up here.
Oh, that's a good thing. What does FE stand for? What is this company?
FE is the short way of saying the Fairbanks Exploration Department of the United States Smelting, Refining, and Mining Corporation, the corporation owned by three little old ladies in Boston who were descendants of the famous clipper ships, of the Yankee clipper ships.
Gosh, and they This outfit had all over the country, Nome and Montana, yes. I guess, in different places.
Yes, operations. The United States Smelting and Refining Company had smelters and mines all over. They owned the Hammond Company up at Nome, where they had two dredges. They owned a big chunk of Butte, Montana. They owned big mines in Chile. And where all else, I don't know.
We're going to be back in just a moment because we're getting close to the time when your young bride arrives in Fairbanks. Back in just a moment with Roy Larson.
Meet a Pioneer is sponsored in part by Interior Signs, long established as one of the interior's most professional, most dependable year-round sign makers. They're licensed, insured, and always ready to serve Fairbanks with signs of every kind. Signs for business, contracting, or creative design. So for signs that stand the test of time, call Interior Signs at 479-3859. That's 479-3859. Interior Signs at 2405 South Cushman.
Alaska's pioneering spirit will never die. It lives on in second and third generation Alaskans like Dr. Carol Davis of Denali Chiropractic Clinic.
Sponsoring Meet a Pioneer gives Carol an opportunity to show her pride in being an Alaskan and in being a member of the world's largest drugless healing profession. Becoming a chiropractor meant years of demanding study, a period of internship, and then meeting tough licensing standards. She's happy to talk about chiropractic with anyone interested in learning more about it. Just call 479-0485 or stop by and see Carol at 3525 College Road.
Thank you, Dr. Davis of Denali Chiropractic Clinic. And now back to our program, Meet a Pioneer.
My guest this morning, Roy A.A. Larson. Well, it was time for Eva to arrive, or Eva, excuse me, in Fairbanks.
Yes, she came in on the 1st of September, and I had left word with her that she should meet, call Eva Collins, who was one of the telephone operators, and her husband came up on the boat with me. And her husband was Clyde Collins and worked at the Road Commission as a mechanic. And she was supposed to be in at night when the train came in. Instead of that, she got on the Brill car, which was a like a street car with a diesel motor on it, and it carried was the same size as a one passenger car on the railroad now. And they had seats for passengers, and they also had a compartment for freight or express. But the railroad at that time was kind of like Toonerville Trolley. That's why the trains didn't come all the way through, because the track was too rough, and the train just stopped halfway at Curry and came in the next day. But the Brill car came straight through and brought perishables and people that, and the but it was such a rough ride, it came through from Seward in 12 hours, like the same time the train does now. And when they got here, why, it was, well, she was like drunk for 2 days. She was just staggering all over the place, just trying to get her balance back from all the shaking up on the Brill car. She got in at 7 o'clock in the morning and finally got him to give her a telephone book so she could look up the number of Eva Collins. And so she got the operator and gave her the number, and the operator says, what number is that, honey? I don't recognize that number. Who are you trying to call? And she said, Eva Collins. And she said, well, honey, we don't ever use numbers. We just ask for who we want because they're not always home. So she got her through to Eva Collins, and Eva sent her husband over to get me. I was staying two or three blocks from their house, and they had her get a cab and come over to the house. And the cab cost 50 cents, and there was, I think, five people that they picked up, and so they just scattered them around where they belonged, and each one paid 50 cents. And so I got over there and met her after, 5 months or so, 4 months.
Mm-hmm.
And we were just hunting for a place when Everett Patton came in from Chattanooga. He ran the Chattanooga Trading Post, and his father was Bob Casey, and running the Circle Hot Springs, and the light plant had gone down at Circle Hot Springs, and so Pat was to go up there and work on it and be up there for about 10 days, and he wanted us to come out and stay at the store with Helen and the kids, and so we did, and that was sort of our honeymoon, was being a storekeeper out there.
That was your honeymoon, huh?
And then we came into town, and Mrs. Brandt, the old-time telephone operator, was really a famous little old lady from that point of view.
Mm-hmm.
And she had a lot of property around the town, and she had a cabin across from the coal bunkers that next to where Kelly's is, that was people were leaving to go outside.
Now that was down, that is downtown Fairbanks, but at the time it was kind of
out on the outskirts,
out of town.
In fact, it was out of town. Yes,
it was out of the city limits, right over by the coal bunker. Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
The city limits was the, well, there's a slough that runs from about where we live now and down right under where Nita's Cafe is, and mm-hmm. down towards the railroad yards, and that was the city limits at that time.
Well, Slaterville was undeveloped then.
It was Slaterville was partially subdivided, and the Slater Street was pretty well built up. Earl Cook and I think one other house was on the next street. Earl built his house that summer.
Mm-hmm.
And otherwise it was just farmland out there.
Uh-huh. Well, then it was about time for you to start school.
Yes, I started in school then after we got back, and Eva went to work in the old hospital for $96 a month. And
St. Joe's.
St. Joe's. She had worked at the Swedish hospital for $82.50 a month, so that was the differential between Seattle and Fairbanks
uh-huh.
at that time.
Well, you went to the School of Mines, as it was known then.
Yes.
And Charles Bunnell was president. You were taking, who were some of your contemporaries? Who were some of the other students, teachers?
I don't remember who the teachers were so much, but some of the others that were going to school at the same time were Doug Culp, Earl Beislein, Ernie Wolf, Olga Steger. Olga Steger and some of the other town kids. And I would, when the weather was nice, we'd walk back from school on the railroad instead of taking the bus, which Paul Griman was running, which we uh-huh. called Nuts and Bolts. It was rattly bang, was ready to fall apart most any time. Others were Evelyn Baker, who's Evelyn Melville now, and Dwayne Hall. And then in Anchorage, the O'Neill kids, Francis and Terry and Pat O'Neill.
Mm-hmm.
And of course there were a bunch of others too. There were, I think, about 350 students and 35 or 40 teachers.
Uh-huh. And that was about 1939 then you started school?
Yes, the winter of 39 and 40.
Uh-huh.
And then I went to school in the fall semester of 41. And then...
Did you complete schooling there?
No, I dropped out then and went to work for the FE company in the warehouse. And
why'd you drop out of school?
Well, things weren't coming out the way I wanted them to. I had switched from mining because I didn't want to become a mining engineer and end up on the survey gang for the FE company, which seemed to be where they all ended up.
Uh-huh.
I got a year-round job for $0.84 an hour as a young engineer for the FE company, and some of them had been there for 5 years at that kind of wages. And
mm-hmm.
It didn't look like what I was trying to, where I was trying to aim my life. So I changed to civil engineering and got quite a bit of calculus, and then I found out that I couldn't set up my calculus problems from field information, and I got discouraged and decided to quit, and we bought the house, and my daughter Nelda was on the way, so it was better to go to work.
You were a family man now.
Getting to that point.
Getting to be one.
But years later, my calculus prof came back to town as a rock hound and came into the store and see if I had any rocks and wanted to know why I didn't finish. And I told him, and he said, well, that's why I was teaching, because I couldn't do that either.
So, tell the story about Dr. Haglin when Nelda was born and the twins.
That's when the Nelda was born. Eva was working for Dr. Haglin at the clinic, and so I had seen Nelda was born, and then a year, 14 months later, my boy Milner was born, and in about that same time, why Dr. Haglin had his twin boys, and he come around very proudly with his thumbs in his vest and say, ah, oh, you're not so hot. He says, it takes a man behind the gun to get twins.
Okay.
He was always up to something like that.
Oh, my. Well, Roy, time goes so fast. We have just about 10 minutes left, and we haven't even gotten to the jewelry store, but we need to tell about how in the world did you get into the jewelry and locksmith business? And you went from FE Company
to the coal bunker and hauling coal. And
now, how long did you haul coal around this town?
For about a year and a half.
I think a lot of people remember that.
And I hauled coal. I worked for Ernie Shermer and Larry Reed. Larry Reed was actually the one that hired me. And when Larry Reed and Ernie Shermer broke up, Larry was buying the Pioneer Express and broke up with Ernie and gave Ernie back his trucks. And so I kept Larry's trucks that were just town trucks. And Larry took the good trucks and went down to Edmonton and hauled the pipe and the camp for the Canal Pipeline. Both from that end and hauled down from Circle for this end of it. And I ran the express business we call Larson and Reed Express. I hauled the first snow removal. Larry designed a scoop to go on the front end of a dump truck, and when you raise the dump, you raise the scoop up. And the city plowed the snow on 2nd Avenue, and I would go and just jam this big scoop into the pile of snow or the berm they made in the middle of the road, and then bring it down by the bridge and on the lower side of the bridge, and run the truck out towards the river and slam on the brakes and drop the scoop, and the snow would slide off into the river. And I got out there about 30 feet over the river with the pile, and putting planks for me to run on, and everybody was around waiting for me to just slide over the top and go into the river, but I never made it.
Oh, my word.
But then
we'll be back in just a moment. We're taking our final break on Meet a Pioneer with Roy Larson.
That was a delicious dinner, dear, and your dining room is so elegant.
The thing that impressed my mother-in-law more than my cooking was the kitchen. She told me the only way to have a kitchen with enough room to move around in, with counter space and convenient cupboards, was to build your own. But here at Sophie's Plaza, I have all that and more. And the kitchen isn't the only beautifully designed room. The whole apartment is...
Find Sophie Plaza is easy. I haven't lost a visitor since we moved here. When someone asks why we chose Sophie Plaza, I tell them quiet, relaxed, plush, and affordable. That's why we live here. Sophie Plaza, not just another place to live, it's a lifestyle. When Roy Larson started Larson's Jewelers on that day back in 1946, he had big dreams of what he'd like his business to become. Over the years, some of those dreams changed and others came true. Today, Larson's is still a family-owned business and one of the finest and most complete jewelry stores in the interior. Almost 40 years of skill and experience go into everything they do. Like Fairbanks, they've grown, but they're still your friend and neighbor. Larson's, fine jeweler since 1946 at 405 Noble.
He is waiting.
You know, Roy, that's fun. I've been listening to this ad for a long, long time, and it's nice to have you on the program. You certainly are a pioneer. Okay, so you hauled coal and first snow removal. Waiting for you to...
When Larry got through hauling pipe, he had several transactions with Al Ghezzi and finally sold all his equipment and everything to Al Ghezzi and ended up with $120,000 in the bank, which was too much money for him to keep. So decided to set up a ready-mixed cement plant, and which he set up the plant up on 10th Avenue, and I set up the gravel pit with slackline outfit. And when Lloyd Pike started his homestead down there in Pike's Landing, and he wanted me to homestead on the adjoining piece of property so we could have an airstrip on land as well as on the river. But I was too busy, but that 160 acres, now the International Airport. So,
oh dear.
Then we got the ready mix going, and I hauled the first ready mix cement, and then had a week's vacation down Donnelly Dome. The road went around the other side, and It was just a mess with the rain. And when I came back from that, I broke up with Larry Reed. We agreed to disagree, and I went to work for Francis Holmstrom with a conditional deal that he'd teach me how to make jewelry and the jewelry business. And I worked there for a year and a half and doing piecework and also a lot of other things, but just being paid for the piecework. And then I had to go back on the trucks again to pay the bills that I'd run up while I was working for Francis, going to school. And we had a Fairbanks Trucking Association got a year's contract to haul military goods and down to the highway camps. And we serviced down as far as Northway. And at the end of the year, we completed that. And then in the summer or fall of that year, which was 1946, we got on a job out at Fort Wainwright, which was Ladd Field then, hauling gravel around the back of the airstrip, the road that goes from the hospital around, clear around, and back into the main area. My partner, Mulder Lindgren, and I each cleared $1,600 and had no work ahead of us for the winter. And so Eva and I decided, since I'd worked a year and a half to go into the jewelry business, that was the time to start. So with that $1,600, I paid some of my bills and bought gold and tools and started up my shop in the basement.
Of your home?
Of my home.
In Slaterville, huh?
And I made gold nugget initials that winter, and I think I made at least two gold nugget initials for every woman in Fairbanks. And then we had to expand and into other things, and people came around, and we had the locksmith, Van Damme, who was also the bartender at the Pioneer Hotel, and he would be his own best customer, and he had quite a filthy mouth when he was drinking, and people would say, "Van's drunk again, why don't you start making keys, get people over here?" So I finally did that, and around 1950 or thereabouts, and then in the military came in and they wanted me to open safes because the crew they had out there in their shops would open the safes, but in doing so they'd ruin the safe. So I figured out how to open safes without wrecking them so they could be repaired, and we went on, and then in the early 60s, Red Boucher came to town and started Pan Alaska with his trophy business, and started also the Gold Panners baseball team, and the Gold Panners were going around taking trophy orders, and they went into one of the places and said that they were, Red was going to take over all the trophy business in Fairbanks and run everybody else out of business if he had to undersell everything and make his money off the military. That didn't do any good, so go over so good, so my wife went to back east on a trip, and she took $2,000 into Chicago and bought an initial setup for making trophies and shipped it in, and so I got into the trophy business and ended up with the three businesses, the trophies and locksmith and the jewelry. And they kind of, each one dovetailed into the other at that time, and with just one or two helpers, why I kept the business going real nice. Then the pipeline came along and everything blew up in my face. We ended up with 17 people working there, and everybody an expert in their own area, and nobody knew anything about any of the others. So that's where we're at now. It's just, we've cut her back to about 14 people, but it's still definitely three different businesses.
That's wonderful. Interesting to know the beginning of that business, and you're the patriarch of the Larson family in Fairbanks. What was it you said about work being a man's...
Oh, work is a man's best friend. That's what I was taught when I was a kid. Anybody that's willing to work can make it. When I came to talk to people about coming to Alaska, every one of them, without exception, said, "It's a young man's country. If you're willing to work, you can make it in Alaska."
Mr. Roy Larson, my guest on Meet a Pioneer.
You've been listening to Meet a Pioneer. A taped version of this interview will become a part of the permanent oral history collection of the Alaskan Polar Regions Department at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. This program was produced by Gail Malloy.
This is David Boren of Oklahoma.
We can say we're glad we've taken a small step in the right direction. There's more to be done. Now we want to make sure that when we come...